The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From The Guidepost of Silent Illumination by Aung Zhur. Vision penetrating into subtle radiance is weaving gold on a jade loom. Upright and inclined yield to each other. Light and dark are interdependent. Not depending on sense, faculty, and object, at the right time, they interact. Drink the medicine of good views. Beat the poison-smeared drum. When they interact, killing and giving life are up to you. So the other day I started with the first couple stanzas of this verse by Aung Zhur on silent illumination. He spoke a little bit about his life. So he was in the Zaldong or Soto lineage that we are part of. He's part of our lineage. So he was the great-grandfather of Dogen. And Dogen, as I mentioned, when he went to China, ended up studying at Jiangtong Monastery, which is where Aung Zhur was abbot. And in fact, oftentimes you'll see him referred to as Jiangtong, as the monastery's name. And he taught this practice of silent illumination. Dogen, coming back to Japan, taught Shikantaza. In a way, I mentioned this a little bit, but if we think of the Buddha nature, that we all have not only the potential to realize Buddha mind, to realize enlightenment, which is an aspect of Buddha nature, but also that we have that very nature already. That is our nature. It's the nature of every living being. And so it's not somewhere else. It's not outside of ourselves. It is uncreated. It's nothing that we can do to get closer to it, to increase it. We can't get away from it. It can never be destroyed. And yet, as the Buddha said, it's subtle, difficult to see. It can't be grasped with the senses. So in a sense, the Buddhist tradition, the project is, if you will, is how to come into direct contact with something that we cannot touch. How to have an experience where subject and object, the experiencer and the experienced, have merged or disappeared. And then how to bring that into cognition, because that's what realization is. It's not just having an experience, it comes into awareness. Dogen says sometimes it's realized before knowing. And that can mean that sometimes the person actually has an insight, a realization, experience, and it's not yet in their cognition, in the sense that they realize what they realized. So if we think about those things, then in a way, Shikantaza is the perfect vehicle, because in Shikantaza, you don't put an object in front of you because everything is already there. You don't direct your attention towards or away because it can't be approached. There's no need to let go of anything because nothing's outside of it. Striving only brings us further away because it's already fully present. And so Shikantaza is really allowing or reclaiming, returning to that basic original mind, that capacity of mind, which is natural, present within all of us, to experience without intrusion, to experience without entanglement. Vision penetrating into subtle radiance is weaving gold on a jade loom. So then the part of the challenge for beginning with the Buddha was how to speak of it. So how do you direct a student towards something given that our conditioning since the beginning of time is to direct ourselves towards lots of things over there. We come seeking the Dharma, being pretty sure that there's something that's not quite right here, because otherwise we'd be fine. And so we go seeking something that's got to be out there, and we encounter the Dharma, the path, teachings. And those teachings are continually turning us back, turning us back, turning us back. And in Zen tradition, the style of teaching is to be very sort of clear about that. That the student arrives with all that they need. They, in a sense, hold not only their capacity, but their spiritual power. And yet we would be ready to give it away for something. I remember moments of struggling, feeling, you know, like it was everything was impossible, and remembering the story of Hueco who cut off his arm. And I thought, well, an arm's a lot, but finger? Like if I could make a deal, would I do a finger? I don't know, maybe. No, it's just not going to work that way. This mind is always aware, vision penetrating into subtle radiance. Our distractedness, our attachments, projections, just dims that awareness. You know, even our language, I lost my awareness. Well, where did it go? You know, is it under your seat? Is it in your right pocket? Right? Did it go home? Did it give up on you? Right? So even our language, our casual language, you know, sort of speaks to our sense of something, but it also kind of reflects what it seems like is happening. I lost it, right? It was there and then it's gone. Oh, and then it came back again. But in fact, the mind is always aware. It's like a bright light. You know, if you've driven in a very strong fog, you know, and the fog just scatters the light. Put on the high beams, it's even worse. The light is fine. The light is bright, but it cannot penetrate the fog. And so all forms of meditation, if not specifically designed to help this, are sort of dependent on this, include that calming aspect, calming the mind. Restlessness, the monkey mind, our distractedness. And as it calms, we begin to experience, see. And seeing here, again, remember, isn't necessarily visual at all. It's experiencing. And it's like that light, that bright light is now penetrating through the fog, or the fog is dispersing. Master Dogen says, we're only able to see to the extent of our penetrating vision, which kind of makes sense, but it's a good thing to keep in mind. That we can only perceive that which we are able to perceive. And so as human beings, our instruments of perception are wonderful, but also limited. There are certain ranges that we work within and ranges we can't work within. And so too with insight, we can only see to the extent that we, our mind, our awareness, is able to see, is ready to see. So as that mind becomes more ripened, more clarified, more open, more the conditions are more suitable, then that vision naturally extends. And as Ongzhar says, it's in this subtlety that we encounter wonder. And so when we chant our everyday activities are wondrous in their simplicity. Sutra of Great Compassion, the dedication. It's really speaking of what Hongzhi is speaking of, that when we can actually experience something in its simplicity, and that doesn't, that means a mindfulness, an undistracted mind, so now we're closer. But there's depths, there's sort of apparently an endless range of possibility in terms of going deeper into that. And so that calming, tranquility, serenity, spoken of in different ways. And then we experience things that have always been there. They haven't changed, but our experience of them changes. People, living things, mountains, rivers, bridges, skyscrapers. Upright and inclined yield to each other, Hongshir says, light and dark are interdependent. Daroshi used to say, when talking about the koans, he would say, they seem paradoxical. He said, but paradox only exists in the mind. The sense that this can't be at the same time as that. That paradox, that sense of lack of mutuality is something that exists in the mind. Because the mind seeks a reference position. It wants to know, where am I? What is this and what is that? And that's based on some system of recognition, of establishing position, of measurement. And all of that is what we're releasing, freeing ourselves of. So when we talk about not judging in Zazen, it's not just having harsh judgments of ourselves and others, but it's actually, do not judge by any standards, we chant in the identity. In other words, don't bring any system of comparison or measurement or evaluation. Let this, see this just as this, experience that just as that, as Hongshir said. And then we see that there's no paradox. Upright is upright. Inclined is inclined. They yield to each other. They're not opposed. They don't fight with each other. They have the same nature. And yet, when sitting, Zazen, upright is best. When sleeping, inclined is quite comfortable. So I mentioned briefly that Hongshir in this, and I just, disclaimer and apology, I'm not going to really treat this poem very well, okay? In the sense that it was way too ambitious to try and cover this in two talks, so I'm not really going to try. So don't listen to these talks as a good, solid sort of commentary on this poem. It's really not. That would have to wait for another time. So one of the things that Hongshir is really working with here, which is really important, is the two truths of absolute and relative. And so I wanted to just say a little bit about that. So sometimes people will ask, why is emptiness important? Like, why is it important for me to study it, to have faith in it, to experience it? And so I was reading a teacher who was talking about the Majjhimagga school, the school of, sometimes called the school of emptiness, sort of begun by Nagarjuna. It's one of the two essential sort of streams that come into the Zen tradition, Mahayana tradition, along with the Yogacara. And so this teacher was talking about this, and he said, one may wonder why so many past great masters made such a fuss about emptiness. And he's talking about the Majjhimagga, and he says, for these great masters in their minds, he said, this was not a speculative metaphysics competing for acceptance as a worldview. And it can sound sometimes, because there's debate and there's, you know, sort of disagreements about certain very fine points, which, you know, unless we really study, it can seem very arcane and sort of like dancing on the head of a pin. And he's saying, but it wasn't just speculative metaphysics competing for, you know, who's best, nor is it a descriptive philosophy attempting to establish a clear description of reality so that we might build our knowledge upon an incontrovertible foundation. It's really, in the best sense of the word, he said, therapeutic. So that the insights that the study, the practice, the realization of emptiness brings, what it reveals to us can cure us of deeply ingrained habits of grasping. It involves to a large extent a form of deconstruction. And I've never really liked that term, although it comes up a lot. And it's not inappropriate because in a very real sense, we have constructed, right? Like you build a house. But when we deconstruct something, we take that house, which was never solid to begin with, and we take away all of its parts. And we don't actually do that, because those parts don't exist as bricks and wood and nails. Even bricks, wood, and nails don't exist the way we think they do. But to go along with what he's saying, it exists to a large extent of form deconstruction, revealing through careful study every concept, every view, Sean talked about yesterday, every existent, to be ultimately contingent, composite, and relational. So that everything we see, everything we experience, everything that we might examine, we see to be contingent, dependent. Nothing exists by itself. It's composite. It's made of aggregates, the skandhas are the aggregates of each of us. If you take a tree or a bridge or a cloud, all of those could be seen as the composite end result of a host of other aspects. And each of those aspects could be seen as composite. And relational, that they're constantly and necessarily in relationship. Nothing exists by itself. Nothing is autonomous. Nothing actually is isolated. And because of all of this, the Buddha taught that attaching to things as though they exist by themselves is inherently unreliable. In a sense, when we depend on that for our happiness, for our sense of being okay with ourselves, for belonging, for success, for a good life, meaning, we will be disappointed. It's built into the system that we create that it will seem to betray us. That contract that we have going will be broken. And so the Buddha said, it is not reliable. And so he taught, use food for food. Use clothing for clothing. Don't look to get from clothing, food, relationships, things that they cannot provide for us. And this teacher went on to say, deeply conditioned by our experience and language and thought structures around things and properties reflected in our language, nouns, adjectives. So every noun describes a thing, right? And most sentences include what I am going to do about or with or under or around or because of that thing. And then the adjectives, what are its qualities? What are its characteristics? In Buddhism, we call those signs. So that our language is constantly pointing to and sort of affirming or seeming to reaffirm that sense that this is a thing. It exists in itself, by itself, apart from other things. Most importantly, me. It has certain characteristics which are the stuff of that thing. And those are those characteristics are the things that we like or don't like. Right? And so he says, because of all that, we instinctively assume that things possess objective existence, definable through some kind of essence that establishes their unique existence and identity. And it is this deep innate assumption of the intrinsic existence of things that forms the basis for our grasping and subsequent attachment to people and things in our lives. And this deep innate assumption is a fundamental delusion that is the target for removal or illumination by anyone who seeks the true freedom of nirvana. So it's just kind of a summation of the whole thing. To be attached to things is illusion. What we ultimately see is attachment not only is not possible, but it doesn't even make sense. It's not even logical unless the things are distinct and separate. And that it's in the direct experience, first studying, understanding. When my Dada Roshi would sit in this hall on the seat and talk about emptiness, and I would imagine some kind of black hole that I was practicing to what? Be thrown into, fall into, you know? I don't know, you know? And I thought, but wait a minute, but like, what about all of this? How can that be? And it just, my mind just kept creating images and mental ideas about what could that be? Because I was looking in my filing cabinet of things that I already knew, right? So if it's emptiness, then emptiness must be, well, if that, or it could be that, or it could be that, because that's what emptiness means. So that's what we have to chuck, right, basically. And that it's in that direct experience, first, as I was saying, just developing the understanding and then cultivating faith. Could that be true? Could it be true that that is the actual nature of things? Well, turn it around. This is an evidence-based practice, right? That's what we want. We don't want to just adopt a philosophy. I'm assuming, if that's what you've been looking for, this has been a terribly hard week for you. And very unsatisfying, I would think. So I think most of us are explicitly not looking for that. And so then we develop faith. So how could that be true? So there are so many ways in which the teachings try and instill that faith, right? So one way is to, well, let's say it was true. Let's say it's true that everything is distinct and separate and has its own autonomy and is permanent. In other words, just take the basic stuff of delusion and make a world of that. And that's reality. That's the truth. That's the reality of things. Then living in accord with that should work out very nicely, right? Because then we're living in harmony with that truth. But that's what we do, and it sucks, right? That's what we do too much of the time, and there's dukkha. So does that help in terms of instilling faith? Well, it can't be that. Maybe it's this. And then the other side, or the other truth of relative, the relative truth, which seems much simpler and easier. In a way, it is. It's what we know. It's what we perceive. It's what we can talk about. We can measure it. But even in Buddhism, certain schools of Buddhism wanting to be very clear, because everything we're doing is based on this, right? So let's get it right. Let's get really understand what are we talking about. So these ancient teachers who were philosophers, referred to as philosophers, but were generally practitioners, wanted to understand things and be able to expound them very clearly so that when we were practicing, as students were practicing, we're doing that based on a accurate map. And so so the relative truth was spoken of in one way as having three criteria. So how do we know if something is a relative truth? So to just say, well, it's, you know, what everybody knows. Yeah, but we know all kinds of different stuff and we argue over it. We don't agree. And so this is not so much, well, so one is, it's a given fact, the relative truth is a given fact that is known to or acknowledged within a conventional cognition. So something that we all experience and we have to basically agree on, right? The ground is hard, water is wet, fire is hot, right? Ice is cold. It's a fact that is known to us through a cognition. And a conventional cognition, like pretty much anywhere you go, there's going to be agreement. That it's not invalidated by some other conventional knowledge. You know, as in Mount Tremper, fire is hot, but if you go 100 miles south, it's cold. So that's not relative truth. There's got to be consistency. And it's also not invalidated by analysis probing the ultimate nature of reality. And I think that's very interesting and important, that as we engage in going beyond what can be measured, beyond what the senses can know, that what we directly experience actually needs to affirm and be consistent with what we know through our senses and all of our measuring instruments, even though they seem very often unreliable. But as they become more reliable, as they are cleared of that fog, as we let go of our views, We see them as views. We see them as beliefs. We see them as constructions in our mind. They don't exist in an absolute sense. Then what we experience in a relative sense becomes more and more the full expression of what we call the absolute or emptiness. And so Hongzhu says, not depending on sense faculty and object, at the right time they interact. Light and dark, up and down, heaven and hell, no longer dependent on sense and faculty. When the mind ceases to discriminate, to divide, to base on love and hate, wanting and not wanting, when subject and object are no longer being created, right? Our mind creates a sense, our consciousness creates a sense of division. That's the teaching of the different levels of consciousness, that our five sense organs just do what their job is. They just see. The eyes just see. That's what they do. The ear just hear. But the sixth consciousness, mental consciousness, perceives that, knows that, likes that, doesn't like that, names that, fantasizes about that. And then the seventh level of consciousness, which is sometimes called the afflictive consciousness, experiences that and says, oh yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me, all right. So that's the aspect of our consciousness that basically misunderstands, misperceives, misknows. It's perceiving something, but it's foggy. It's not clear. And it sort of grasps at this sort of lowest hanging fruit. Well, something's out there. It's got to be not me. Something's right here. That's got to be me. And so practice is to illuminate that mind. Through the gate, the self emerges and the branches bear fruit. I'm just going to be skipping around now. Only silence is the supreme speech, only illumination the universal response. So this is something, the gates of our senses is something that basically every spiritual tradition reckons with, right? Because it's pretty clear in anybody who examines that through our senses we see, we hear, we taste, and we like and we don't like, we want and we don't like, and then we go fighting over stuff. So the senses are often perceived as the culprit. So if you think of ascetic practices that are starving those senses, right, closing those gates to try and purify, to not allow any kind of temptation, right? That kind of makes sense from that perspective. To restrain, right, to shut down, to not trust. And even in Buddhism, the senses are sometimes referred to as the thieves, right? Because through our senses, like, we get stolen away. We get taken away. We get lost in things. But in the Mahayana, what's understood is that the senses are fine. They're amazing. They do precisely what they're intended to do. It's mind consciousness that's befuddled, that's a little confused, quite confused. And then the rest is what we do with that. And so through the gate, it is true that the self emerges. We come forth, right? And we can either get entangled and project and misknow, but as not the gate, but the mind consciousness becomes more and more clear, more true, more reliable, then we see more and more that the gates are fine. That's why we sit with them open. When we sit in the sendo, the gates are open, right? We sit with our eyes open, the ears are open. We don't, you know, we try and make it pretty quiet. But we can't control the world, so we've got roosters, right? We've got motorcycles, we've got each other, Doksan Bell, Daisan Bell, Memorial Day weekend, Saturday night, we might have music tonight from our neighbors. And so we don't like batten down the hatches and try and make a completely silent, like a tranquility, what they call a tranquility tank. Right, there's no stimulation of senses, because that's not going to help us. One, because it feeds into the idea that the gates are the problem, the senses are the problem. But two, because what do we do when we come out of that box? And so we're practicing within our senses, not being stolen. And when something takes us away, we come back. Right? When we get confused, we clarify. When they get dull, we sharpen. Silence is the supreme speech. Illumination, the universal response. Universal in the sense that it's universal. It's a human thing. That's how we can be sitting in this hall following the teachings and the practices that began over 2,500 years ago. That's a long time. And that have come from such a different, not just one time and place and culture, but many times and places and cultures and languages. Remember the role of language. And that this can be as modern and contemporary and relevant and speak to exactly what we experience as human beings, because that's the universal. And so the teaching has to be universal in that sense. It can't be dependent upon a certain time, because otherwise it goes out of date. It's got an expiration date, right? But it also has to be malleable, pliant, right? So that it can speak in every time to each culture, through each language, to this group of people. And that's a dance, right? Because if it's not pliant, it becomes rigid. And we see examples of that. If there's no continuity, if it loses that universal sense and it's just responding to what we think we need now, how do we know? How do we know what we need? Because it's no longer based in that essentially human wisdom. Responding without falling to achievement, Hongzhi says, that's the tough one. Right? Responding without falling into achievement. You know, we can think, and sometimes people say, I'm not intellectual. You know, I'm not intellectual. And so as though I don't get tangled up in my thoughts. Everybody's intellectual. It doesn't mean having lots of degrees. It doesn't mean being a philosopher. It just means having a conceptual mind. And that having a great deal of power. We can also think, I'm not competitive, you know. And that maybe that's true, but don't hold on to that idea too much, right? Because we see the ways in which we have been so deeply taught about how the world works, about how you get things. How do you succeed? How do we get ahead? How do we get what we want? And so to respond without falling into achievement, to practice, to seek without falling into achievement. So we just have to know that we're going to fall into achievement and to seek an achievement. We're going to fall into all of the things that we, you know, want to free ourselves of because they cause a lot of pain and confusion. But to expect that we're not going to do that is setting ourselves up. So better to just develop understanding to be able to recognize when we have fallen. Oh. And then to know how to respond. And then you're good. Good-ish. Right? Good in the sense that you don't have to worry, you know, will that ever arise again? And people give voice to that. Oh, this is still arising. After all these years, this is still arising. So that's the power of language. It reveals us. It reveals our view. It reveals like, oh, I expect that I'm going to get to a point where this no longer arises. That's my bargain with the Dharma. Right? And it's still happening. So what's up? So are we not practicing right? Is there something wrong with the Dharma? Or are we misknowing? Do we have a misunderstanding that we're applying to our practice? And that then causes some trouble. So better just to know how to practice. And that's why, in a way, it's important to go through as much as you can. Right? Hell realms, ghost hungry ghost realms, animal realms, God realms. Don't stay there too long. So that we're experiencing all of those existences within ourselves and discovering how to meet that self that emerges through the gates, right? And to develop patience and faith and courage and peacefulness. Silence is the supreme speech. There is something, it just seems to be true, that becomes possible when the mind is serene, in which there is no thought. There is a level of awareness and clarity and incisiveness, a penetrating vision that opens up to us in that. But it's really also important to hold that in an open hand, because words themselves do not obscure. We just have such a long relationship with words and language in our mind. But when we really understand how ephemeral, how fleeting, how cloud-like they are, and not just understand, but we experience them that way more and more, that less and less do thoughts arise and just undo us, overwhelm us, take us away, crush us, then silence becomes much larger. There can be silence within a thought. There's tranquility within a thought. But I was remembering, I gave a retreat on distractions years ago, and there's a quote by Blaise Pascal, he said, distraction is that which consoles us for our miseries, right? We distract ourselves away from it. Yet it itself is the greatest of our miseries, right? That's not a great system. Talk about unreliable. Responding without falling into achievement. So, you know, I've talked about how in years past, you know, there would be times where Dadarushi and Dokusan are sitting here, we'd be talking about, you know, no goals, no striving, you know, giving up achievement, giving up success and failure. And I would think, yeah, it's easy for you to say, right? And I said, you know what, I'll give all of that up when I'm enlightened. That's my bargain, right? Because before then, I just don't see how that's going to work. How can I achieve without achieving? How can I gain without gaining? How can I accomplish without striving? I just couldn't figure out, how could I do that? The very thought of it was, I did not trust it, and it frightened me. Because to me, that sounded like, I don't know, giving up, don't do anything. It was a level of trust that I did not have, right? Because it seemed so remote from anything that I had known or done in my life, right? And so what helped to shift that? My misery, my sustained and ongoing and consistent and more clearly created misery. That while I kept just trying harder and harder and to be more and more clever and adept and sincere. I mean, I wasn't trying to game the system, right? I was actually sincere, but unwilling to relinquish the thing that I felt like had brought me along all the way. And the only thing that began to urge me into that was my sustained effort that you kept yielding the same results. And I got to the point where it's like, you know, I am not going to compare myself to the Buddha, but when the Buddha was in his asceticism and he almost died, right, because he took it that far, and then he said, it is not possible to take this any further. Like he showed that to himself. I'm not abandoning this because I'm, you know, a wuss, right? Because I don't have what it takes. He clearly did. I'm abandoning it because I've shown myself that it cannot work. I have done the thing, so it must be the assumption that the thing is based on. the idea of what this is and how it will lead to liberation has to be faulty. And so how each of us comes to that in our own way, you know, it's sort of like, what is hitting bottom? What do we need to experience to begin to relinquish those deepest held, dearest, most cherished things that we don't even think of as cherished? I didn't think of that as my cherished attachment, you know, striving. It wasn't like, I love you. It wasn't like that. It was just like, I don't know what else to do. You know, is there anything else to do? It was cherished in that way. In a way, a lack of imagination. And so to be a spiritual practitioner, to cut a new pathway in the practice, in our mind, in our actual brain, it seems, we have to open up a new circuit. Right? We actually have to do something that is different than what we've done before. And in that way, the path is solitary. Because when you do that, you're alone. At the moment when that happens, there's an aloneness that is happening. Because in a sense, we're departing from everything we knew. We're departing, in a sense, from much of what we've known and how we've known to be and the people we've known to be this way. And we don't actually know what happens next. We don't know. And so that's where the faith becomes so important. That's where the incredible wealth, not just of the body of teachings, but of all of these years, you know, I mean, all of these years of testing these teachings and verifying them. And why, you know, like in one generation, it was like all of these sincere practitioners, these really capable people, discovered that it's not true. It doesn't work. There was a fatal flaw, right? That doesn't seem to have happened. And so that we can, when we invoke the ancestors, when we reflect on these teachings that go back hundreds and hundreds of years, and the people, the practitioners, Hongzhu is just reporting to us. And to let that really build us, give us faith in ourselves, because that's why he's teaching. It's not just to hear himself sing. He wants us to know. The Buddha wanted us to know. And not just know, but wanted us to be invited in to have that faith, to actually engage in this practice and verify that for ourselves. You know, I often speak of Ango as, when we begin Ango, I have this image of a ship leaving harbor. All aboard, right? Out into the open sea. And on this voyage, all kinds of things, births, deaths, stormy weather, peaceful calm, things planned, things unexpected. And then here we are. The harbor lights are in view. So, I'll end with some words of Dogen. Please, honored followers of Zen, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not doubt the true dragon. Devote your energies to the way of direct pointing at the real. Revere the one who has gone beyond learning and is free from effort. Accord with the enlightenment of the Buddhas. Succeed to the samadhi of all the ancestors. Continue to live in such a way, and you will be such a person. The treasure store will open of itself, and you may enjoy it freely. Dogen said, release, cast off the self, throw everything into the house of Buddha, and there you may enjoy all that there is freely.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.